From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The news this week coming out of the Middle East jolted many observers accustomed to hearing the usual sound bites from the usual suspects in the Israel-Palestinian conflict. The media here made much of Ariel Sharon's first ever utterance of the O word, occupation, to describe Israel's presence in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. But writers in the Arab press were less impressed. Peter Valenti, contributing editor for the World Press Review, closely watches the news being reported in the Arabic press. He says many of the op-eds reflect an underlying pessimism, not only about President Bush's commitment to the fragile new peace process, but about Sharon's willingness to see the so-called roadmap succeed.
A really interesting op-ed that came out of Jordan's El Ra'i on the 28th, written by Fayez Rashid, was entitled The Israeli Ness, which means no and yes combined together. Sharon is sending signals where it sounds like he's saying, yes, yes, I want peace, I want to negotiate. But at the same time, he's sending signals covertly or not so covertly that say, no, I don't want it. It's sort of a wink, nod, you know what I mean kind of situation. Also, numerous writers point to the fact that this is the man, Sharon that is, who never voted for any peace treaty with Jordan, with Egypt, or with the PLO.
Let's move to the Persian Gulf. In the wake of the war in Iraq, there's been some nerves about the United States increasing bellicose language with respect to Iran, the latest accusing Iran of harboring al-Qaeda terrorists. What is the buzz in the Arab press about these developments?
Arab writers in general have rushed to the defense of Iran. You have an op-ed coming out of Jordan's Dastur, which emphasized that these threats coming from the United States is just falling in line with the U.S. plan to dominate the Gulf. The common opinion is, as emphasized in the Dastur, Iran has much larger oil production capabilities than any other nation, and obviously it's a member of the Axis of Evil. Thus, the United States is really going to focus intense pressure on Iran. An op-ed out of Al-Ahram, which comes out of Egypt, was just continuing this idea that the squeeze that is happening to Iran is reminiscent of the squeeze that was put on Saddam prior to the attack on Iraq. And it's just another form of psychological warfare. The United States knows that Iran has arrested members of Al-Qaeda. It has participated to some degree in cracking down on terrorism.
Well, that brings us to Saudi Arabia. The Islamist extremism that Saudi Arabia had exported for so many years has now come home to roost with the bombings in Riyadh. What are we reading from the Saudi press about its sudden, very intimate experience with al-Qaeda?
Well, this is a really interesting story, and writers from a variety of the Gulf nations are weighing in. To begin with, we had an interesting op-ed in Asiasa, which is a Kuwaiti political daily. Up until those bombings, the Gulf states saw al-Qaeda as a security issue only. Now it's time to see al-Qaeda as not only a security issue, but also an economic, social, political, and even psychological issue. We saw an op-ed in the Sharq al-Awsat on the 18th, which was very pointed and said Saudi Arabia needs not only to strengthen the Ministry of Interior to deal with al-Qaeda, but also the Ministry of Education. There needs to be reforms made. The Riyadh bombing enables Saudi Arabia to claim that it is not soft on terrorism. Because if you look at these bombings in Riyadh, Saudis are victims too. And this was expressly demonstrated by Saudi Foreign Minister Saud Faisal. A lot of coverage was given to some interviews where he said, look, we've been attacked too. We've been fighting al-Qaeda too.
Another Saudi minister, Interior Minister Prince Naif, also had a remarkable statement during the course of the week that had kind of echoes of Ari Fleischer's notorious be careful of what you say remarks from a year or so ago. He urged the Saudi press to be a tool of social stability and to strengthen cohesion in Saudi society. Was he, in effect, telling the Saudi press to be careful of what it says? And what was the response to that?
Absolutely. I don't necessarily want to draw a direct parallel between what's happening in the United States, between the Pentagon and the State Department, but you essentially have a similar kind of conflict because as the foreign minister, Saud al-Faisal, is making all these elated comments on how successful Saudi Arabia's counterterrorism actions are proceeding, you then have Interior Minister Naif cautioning or trying to limit the amount of information that is going out in the press publishing.
As you look at the press coverage and as you try to understand the implicit conflicts that are bubbling up to the surface, can you come away thinking anything but that there are tectonic changes underway right now that will soon come quaking to the surface?
Absolutely. We see a lot of interesting developments in the Gulf in particular, and Saudi Arabia is the best example. Obviously, some kind of change is going to happen there. There's so much talk about it, references being made by a variety of ministers, and there's a lot of pressure in the form of groups, intellectuals, leaders of the business community making petitions to the king, but also in the number of op-eds and editorials from the major newspapers which are calling for change, democratization, inclusiveness in Saudi governing.
Well, Peter, as always, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Peter Valenti, who teaches Near East Civilization at New York University, is a contributing editor for World Press Review. During some of the heaviest ground fighting of the Iraq War, the Palestine Hotel, temporary home to dozens of Western journalists and at 17 stories one of the tallest buildings in Baghdad, was shelled by a U.S. tank. Two reporters were killed, three injured, amid explanations by the Pentagon that did not square with reports from other journalists present. The Committee to Protect Journalists called for an investigation, and this week the results of its own internal investigation were released. CPJ's Deputy Director Joel Simon joins me once again to go through the details. Joel, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Bob.
Is there any reason to believe, based on your investigation, that the commander who ordered that tank fire knew that the building he was firing on housed foreign journalists?
Well, there's a number of key incidents that suggest that certainly the commanders in Baghdad were aware that the Palestine Hotel was out there and was full of Western journalists. We know this because one of the commanders, Colonel David Perkins, on the morning of this major battle, had gone to an AP reporter, Chris Tomlinson, and said, "We are under fire. We're thinking of calling it an airstrike. We know the Palestine Hotel is out there, and we need your help locating it." Tomlinson got on the phone to his bureau in Doha, Qatar, and asked them to make a call to the Palestine Hotel and asked them to hang bedsheets out the window in order to help soldiers on the ground identify the building.
So that they would know what not to fire.
Exactly. And while this exercise was going on, the tank on the bridge fired. Immediately after the hotel was hit, another commander came on the radio and said, "Who the hell just hit the Palestine Hotel?" After some time, Captain Philip Wolford, who was the commander of the tank unit, came on and said, "Well, I did." And the colonel was extremely angry and said that this was a serious matter and the hotel was not to be hit. So our indications are that superior officers, the colonel and the lieutenant colonel who were overseeing the battle, were aware that the hotel was out there. They were making efforts to avoid that the hotel might be hit. Apparently, that concern was not conveyed to the commander of this tank.
In your report, you say that the shelling, however accidental, was itself disproportionate, that even if there were sniper fire coming from the Palestine Hotel, as the Pentagon asserts, that tank fire into the hotel is a disproportionate response. Is that your position?
Well, look, there's a debate about this, but the point is sniper fire simply is not a threat to a tank. And if you know that a building is full of civilians, it's certainly something you need to take into account. But the point is, right now, we don't believe that explanation. We don't believe that they were firing at a sniper. Based on the information that's been provided to us by journalists who were there, there was no sniper, there was no fire. And the only explanation that makes sense to us is that they had located a spotter or what they, a person they believed to be a spotter, which in all likelihood was a journalist who was observing this battle.
How do you explain the Pentagon's repeated assertions that, against all the evidence that you've been able to gather, that there was fire coming from the Palestine Hotel? Is it a question of that's our story and we're sticking with it?
That could be one explanation. The other could be that the failure of communication was significant, and perhaps that's not something that the Pentagon wants to acknowledge publicly. And in fact, that's why we continue to insist that this incident must be fully and publicly investigated. We do not have any clear indication that that kind of investigation is taking place. We certainly hope it will, not only to clarify what happened in this particular incident, but to ensure that similar incidents do not occur in the future.
And one final thing. You are with the Committee to Protect Journalists, and this is a show called On the Media, so I guess we don't need to apologize for making the journalists the center of this story. But in the larger picture, did the media pay too much attention to two casualties at the Palestine Hotel because the two men who had been killed happened to be journalists, you know, at a time when men and women in uniform and Iraqi civilians were dying every day?
Perhaps, but the one thing about reporting is you report on what you know and what you observe. And this was one of the few incidents during the entire war in which there were so many witnesses. So we are able, by talking to those witnesses, to reconstruct what happened. And I think in some ways it's emblematic of probably many, many moments on the battlefield.
All right, Joel. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joel Simon is the Deputy Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. We'll link to the CPJ report, Permission to Fire, on our website, onthemedia.org.
Coming up, a talk with an alleged New York Times transgressor and the legacy of Janet Cook.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Rick Bragg, the Pulitzer Prize-winning feature writer, late of the New York Times, fills his stories with colorful quotations from colorful people saying just the right thing in just the right way. To read a Rick Bragg piece is to ask, where does he find these folks? As it turns out, he doesn't, necessarily. A week ago, it was revealed that one of Bragg's pieces about a Louisiana oysterman was substantially reported by an unpaid stringer, an unofficial intern who went to Apalachicola and harvested all of the quoted material and description for Bragg's story, but received no credit for it. Murmurs about the story led to an investigation by the paper, which, in the wake of the Jason Blair scandal, suspended Bragg for 2 weeks. Whether Rick Bragg is a journalistic cheat or sacrificial lamb depends on whom you're talking to, but he cut short some of the debate by resigning Wednesday from the New York Times to finish 2 books. He joins me now from his home in New Orleans. Rick, welcome to OTM.
No, thank you.
Well, how's your week going so far?
Well, I actually feel pretty good right now. I have never enjoyed, I don't know too many people who do actually like waking up to tension, and I'm happy to be free of it.
Did you do anything wrong journalistically that you believe you have to answer for?
What I did was send a trusted stringer and a talented stringer to report an interview for me in a place. If the story had been broader, if it had involved the things I intended it to involve, then I do believe that this would have been absolutely acceptable by any standard. But it was a narrower story. And the reason it was narrower was because what he got was so vivid and so strong and so compelling that it edged everything else out. And anyone who has ever written a newspaper story knows that when you sit down to write it, plans go often out the window. And you write, you use the most compelling material that tells your story. And I will never apologize for using the most compelling material to tell my story. I just am not going to do it.
I think one of the reasons that people are so amazed about this story is that they're agog, that you had these kind of resources at your disposal to do the heavy lifting, or at least the local reporting in a story. Did you abuse the privilege?
No, I don't think I abused the privilege. No one should be agog over the use of a stringer. The Stringer Network has been around a long time. Lots of newspapers dip into that to help them, you know, do their job. I used Jay West on the Apalachicola story because he was my summer intern. He was very talented. He'd worked full-time for a small paper already, and he wanted to do it. And the piece was going to generally be a larger piece. It was going to be a broader piece. I was going to work the water wars in Atlanta into it. I even envisioned a lead originally that would have been from Atlanta.
You've made it very clear that you don't wish ex post facto to bash the Times over this or anything else.
Absolutely not.
Nonetheless, I have a couple of questions I want to ask you about the provenance of this tempest.
Okay.
First, absent the Jason Blair debacle, do you believe this question would have come up?
Oh, of course not. Of course not. It never would have come up.
3 weeks ago, if someone had said, hey, Rick, it's come to our attention that you have used this unpaid stringer to do the lion's share of the local reporting in this story, and we believe that he didn't get the credit he deserved, would it have led to your resignation?
Oh, of course not. It wouldn't have led to anything. Of course not. But it's a different time now. Wishing that it were not a different time does not, you know, fix it.
What have you learned from all of this?
Well, I guess in a way it's hard to say. If I say that I wished I had worked harder to get the young man a byline, then that is kind of a moot point because I know that we probably would not have been able to get him a byline. But this is hard to answer.
Rick Bragg, famously a fashioner of vivid leads. What's your lead?
Well, I guess I just have to say that he walked off with some regrets and a whole lot of relief. But his regrets don't have anything to do with his stories. They just have to do with sticking around a little bit too long to try and write them.
Well, Rick, thank you very much.
No, listen, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Author and Pulitzer Prize winner Rick Bragg is a former national correspondent for the New York Times.
There is journalistic misdemeanor, such as Rick Bragg's use of unnamed stringers to gather facts for his stories. And then there's journalistic grand larceny, that catalog of fabrication and plagiarism committed by Jason Blair. When a practice like Bragg's comes to light, it's usually corrected by a change in the rules. But when a scandal like Blair's hits the headlines, well, that's supposed to change the profession. When a reputable newspaper lies, it poisons the community. Every newspaper story becomes suspect, declared a New York Times editorial. Great publications magnify the voice of any single writer. Thus, when their editors or publishers want or need to know a source for what they print, they have to know it and be able to assure the community or the courts that they do. Where this is not now the rule, let this sad affair at least have the good effect of making it the rule. That editorial was published on April 17, 1981, about the presumably profession-transforming transgressions of a Washington Post reporter named Janet Cook. Cook was 26, talented, and black, a big plus in a mostly white newsroom in a mostly black city. She was rapidly promoted. She wrote a powerful piece about drug abuse in D.C. centered on an 8-year-old heroin addict named Jimmy. She won the Pulitzer Prize. Then it became apparent that she'd invented her star character. She was, in many ways, like Jason Blair.
These were both attractive people. I mean, they were smart. They were articulate. Editors get caught up with them, and they perhaps give them too long a leash to operate in ways that perhaps some other reporters don't get to operate.
Michael Gettler is a former Post reporter and editor, now its ombudsman. He says that after the Cook debacle, the paper changed.
One of the things that did happen at the Post is that the star system was diminished because it did exist here and it exists at the Times, I'm sure. There was also, I think, an immediate impact on the culture of the newsroom. It was clear that editors had to inquire more frequently about the sources of stories, that communications generally had to be improved throughout the newsroom. There had to be a much more open process so that doubts by reporters or junior editors about particular stories could surface.
Back then, the Post was run by Ben Bradley, a flamboyant, autocratic, risk-taking editor like the Times' Howell Raines today. The newsroom culture was similar, and their scandals were similar, but not entirely the same.
The kind of thing that Jason Blair did is very different from what Janet Cook did.
Hendrik Hertzberg is a staff writer for The New Yorker.
You know, hers was a great big invention. Janet Cook's was more like a big bank robbery, and Jason Blair's was more like gradual embezzlement.
So the editors responsible for Cook failed to catch her in her one big lie. But the Times' top editors had plenty of chances to catch the myriad distortions of Jason Blair. One prominent reason they didn't? Blair's victims never called to complain. Some critics say that's because they had no one to complain to.
Thank you for calling the reader comment line at the New York Times. Your message will reach a responsible editor very promptly. If you're calling to comment about news developments or an editorial or about newspaper delivery, please see the information on page 2 of the paper. If you're calling as an individual about a correction or with a coverage question we can answer, we will try to reply. Please.
I think readers want to have someone, a name, that they can call and ask for and talk to instead of just leaving a message. It's very impersonal. Well, I think it's arrogant.
For years, Lou Gelfand used to call the New York Times switchboard to point out errors of fact. He would be transferred to the National Desk, where, he says, the response was courteous and unavailing. Nor have more recent calls to the correction line resulted in callbacks or printed corrections, although he concedes that the Times does print a lot of them. He counted 214, almost 8 a day, in the 4 weeks ending May 10th. But he says that's not good enough.
The plain and simple fact is that they don't want to be criticized. If they wanted to be criticized, if they wanted to be responsive to the public, they'd have ombudsmen.
Gelfand is the longest-running ombudsman in American journalism, serving that role for the Minneapolis Star Tribune for the last 22 years. The ombudsman is the person to complain to, an independent observer, neither apologist nor scold. But he takes the complaints and unpacks them, usually in a column, and responds to hundreds of readers a week.
I think they can enhance the newspaper's credibility by taking an issue and discussing it thoroughly, and if the ombudsman feels that the paper blew it, was wrong, to say so.
The Washington Post had an ombudsman back in 1981, but no ombudsman could have prevented the Cook debacle. But what about Jason Blair? What if readers were used to complaining to a person at the Times? And what if suspicions about Blair, instead of merely circulating in memos among mid-level editors, found their way into an ombudsman's column in its pages?
I think if the Times elects to name an ombudsman, that the other papers will follow suit. Jason Blair definitely could be the best thing that has happened to not just the Times, but the other papers.
Right now, there are only 32 papers that employ ombudsmen out of more than 1,400.
I do think that for small papers, a single ombudsman makes sense.
The New Yorker's Hendrik Hertzberg.
But for the big, important national papers, something a little more elaborate is probably called for, the equivalent of an inspector general's office.
Maybe that'll be a lasting legacy of Jason Blair. And maybe a reduction of the star system, better communication among high and low-level editors, and better checking up on facts, starting with a reporter's resume straight through to his confidential sources. But as the Times noted in its editorial in 1981, that should have been the lasting legacy of Janet Cook. I put it to the Post-Ombudsman Michael Gettler. Did Janet Cook have any lasting impact on the profession? Because it sure doesn't seem like it.
Well, it's like the Vietnam War. You know, you get a new generation of reporters who don't even know about it or hadn't heard about it or weren't aware of the impact of it. But I think it did put in place a general culture which guards against that happening again.
So you think maybe you need a Janet Cook or a Jason Blair in every generation?
Well, hopefully not. I mean, hopefully you don't need that, but it sure provides a stimulus.
Ombudsman could possibly prevent the next Jason Blair fiasco from coming down the pike, but there may be yet another way to achieve accuracy. Mistakes could be caught by fact-checkers. According to Brendan Kerner, they do it all the time in the magazine world. Kerner examined the culture of fact-checking for Slate. Brendan, welcome back to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
Your recent explainer was called, "Who Uses Fact-Checkers Anyway?" Well, let's start with the obvious question. Who does not use fact-checkers?
Well, for the most part, it's daily publications like newspapers, and it's really a matter of the sheer volume of stories being printed. The turnaround time is so quick, there might be only a few hours between the time a story is turned in at, say, midnight and the time it hits the streets at 5 or 6 a.m. But there are quite a few stories in papers nowadays that have a more investigative bent. And you've actually seen a few papers experiment with checking some of these stories. For instance, the San Jose Mercury News has experimented with checking technology and science stories because they've actually set up, experimentally at least, an advisory board filled with technologists and scientists to go over some of the more complex stories that pass through the paper. So I think there's room for some stories, but in the case of the stories that Mr. Blair fabricated for the New York Times, I think that's quite difficult because many of them were beat stories and the sniper beat working on the families of POWs. Those are things that had to go in the paper right the next day, only a few hours after he turned them in. And it's almost impossible with those kinds of time pressures to do adequate fact-checking.
Magazines come out weekly or sometimes monthly, sometimes once every other month. They have a lot more time to check facts. But what's their methodology? How do they do it?
The typical approach is you have a fact desk which takes copy from a writer and they expect a source list and a list of documents that the reporter relied on to construct the story. Then they go through really with a fine-tooth comb and they call up every source. They don't check quotes necessarily, but they will check titles. They will check, say, if a source says this is a fact or this is the way things are. They're not going to take the source's word for it. They'll try and go and get backup for that fact the source cited. And it really is a pretty onerous process. It ranges, but you know some of the most legendary fact departments, like those at The New Yorker and The Atlantic Monthly, they really go through each and every sentence and make sure everything is on the up and up.
Yeah, I actually once did a piece for Playboy, and having come from the world of newspapers, was simply not aware that they were going to be vetting my story for accuracy. And I reported my piece accurately, but, you know, sloppily. And how surprised was I when they asked me to come up with all this information on absolutely every single assertion I made in my piece, and I was thoroughly unprepared for that. None of my notes were in proper condition. It was an eye-opener for me.
Well, certainly magazine journalists become used to that, and they really do try to take very precise notes, often electronic notes nowadays, which can then be forwarded to the fact department. And they also are expected to annotate their stories quite often. I remember when I was working at U.S. News & World Report, the common practice was for us to mark off each little fact in the story with a letter and then have a corresponding piece of paper that would either have a source's phone number or would be a document that supported that assertion. So you'd have these huge fact files that might be, you know, the thickness of a good-sized coffee table book going down to the fact department every week.
Now, this process is not foolproof. In one of the more bizarre journalistic scandals of the last few years, Stephen Glass, who was writing for the New Republic magazine, actually manipulated the fact-checking system at the magazine. How did he pull that off?
I think the first thing he did that's most interesting is that he would cite unnamed sources. Then when the fact department asked him, you know, to say, hey, who gave you this fact, who gave you this quote, he'd say, well, someone I can't tell you, they gave it to me, you know, top secret, and if you call them, they'll freak out and never talk to me again. And there was a level of trust at that magazine at the time whereby his word was taken, word is bond, that they were like, okay, we're not going to ruin things for you. That was one part of his deception. The second part was really that he would actually set up fake voicemail boxes and even a fake web page to correspond to a fake company once.
That's unbelievable. And, of course, it requires more effort than just simply getting the facts right to begin with. So when it comes to accuracy in newspapers, Brendan, I guess we are just plain screwed. We're right back where we started, which was just having to trust the source.
Well, I think that's true, but I think you have to keep in mind that thousands of reporters out there really take their time to make sure every single fact in their stories is accurate. So I don't think we should say that this one anomaly proves that newspapers are therefore somehow unreliable.
And radio shows?
Radio shows I don't know about. Those are a little dicey.
Brendan, as always, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Bob.
Brendan Koerner is the explainer columnist for Slate.com. And who checks your work?
Absolutely no one. No fact checkers at Slate. But I am trustworthy.
Well, I guess time will tell.
Coming up, the FCC stonewalls the public over a public trust. Also, a reality show that rocked the EU and Roger Ailes unveiled.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation. Helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities. On the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Monday, the FCC will decide whether to allow cross-ownership of newspapers and TV stations in many markets, and whether to raise the limits on how many TV stations one company can own. Last Thursday, demonstrators in a dozen cities gathered to protest the FCC's drive to deregulate.
FCC, don't brainwash me!
But if a demonstration about FCC rulings falls on deaf ears, does it make a sound? FCC Chairman Michael Powell scheduled only one public hearing on the subject and even refused to make the rule changes public. Eric Bollard wrote about the FCC's responsiveness, or lack thereof, in Salon.com. In most proceedings, he says, the commission hears only from a few technocrats, lobbyists, and communications attorneys who have a financial stake in the outcome. But this time, the outpouring from private citizens has been overwhelming.
About 2 weeks ago, an activist group, the Future of Music, which is opposed to the consolidation, they did a study. They went onto the FCC's website and got access to 9,000 of the public comments. And after they weeded out the comments from companies and lobby associations, pro and con, and they just looked at the comments strictly from citizens, 9,000 plus comments, they found 11 private citizens who were in favor of lifting the regulation caps. To say it's overwhelmingly opposed is an understatement. Since that, the large grassroots organizations on the right, it was the NRA, and on the left, organizations like Move On and Common Cause, they contacted all their members, and they have since sent in hundreds of thousands of postcards and comments opposed to the consolidation. So it's unprecedented in terms of the outpouring and interest in the public comments, and it's unprecedented in terms of the overwhelming sentiment of the public comments.
Does the FCC, or any other federal agency for that matter, have to heed the advice that it gets from the various parties during the public comment period, or is it, you know, strictly informational?
No, the FCC does not technically have to take into account what anyone says. But the idea is, you know, in theory, the FCC is supposed to be regulating the communications industry on behalf of the public. And so it would be nice if they took into account what the public thought, if they went to the trouble of asking the public what they thought. Now they know, and the critics are saying Powell doesn't care what the public thinks. This was a done deal, and the vote's going to go ahead. And it sort of makes a mockery out of the whole process.
The Democrats on the FCC staged a series of public meetings. Although the chairman didn't care to participate, they staged them anyway. What was the outcome of those meetings?
I think the effect was to get people talking about the issue. Certainly, 5-6 months ago, if there was very little TV press coverage today, there was none then, and even the newspapers were doing relatively little. The commissioners wanted to get people talking about this, and I think they worked. And I think that when people hear about this, almost everyone has the same reaction. It's hard to find people on the street and say, do you think, you know, GE and CBS should be able to own more and more? You just don't find many people who say, yes, of course, please let them buy my newspaper and all my radio stations.
Now, in a fairly rare media appearance, Chairman Powell was on CNN earlier this week. He said he doesn't believe that it's the FCC's responsibility to, quote, govern by polls and surveys, but rather to make a decision when the record is complete. And then he went on to say that the record is now complete. Well, if he's not talking about the public comment, what is he talking about?
That's a good question. I mean, one of the ironies is, again, these Democratic commissioners took these shows on the road, and Powell said, look, we've heard from the public. We've had tens of thousands of public comments. The public has never spoken up about an issue like this before. And he sort of hails it as a high-tech advancement in this sort of public discourse. But what he fails to always mention is that 99.9% of the comments are opposed to the consolidation. So, yeah, I guess the record is complete. It just depends on which record you're looking at, the record that the communication companies have put forward or the record that, you know, the public has amassed.
In looking at the question, why is Chairman Powell and the Republican majority on the FCC so hell-bent on deregulating the broadcast industry? So far, I think the consensus is that it's principally an ideological impetus. But an organization called the Center for Public Integrity released a study last week about the FCC's travel habits and who's picking up the tab. Tell me about that.
Well, it was probably not surprising, but I mean, overwhelmingly, the people who are picking up the tab are these large communication companies. I mean, the numbers were staggering. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of trips over the last few years. And it's not just commissioners, it's their staff. If you're a company lobbying the FCC, you get direct access, you get to travel with the people. But if you're a private citizen, you essentially get to write an email that goes into a pile in the basement somewhere as public comments. It's interesting, you know, two of the Democratic commissioners did 10 of their own public hearings, and they were essentially told by the FCC, we have no money, we have no budget for these. So they essentially did it out of their pocket. And then it turns out, you know, I think there have been 150 trips to New Orleans in the last few years alone for the FCC, paid by private communication companies. So it's an insight to how the FCC really works.
Eric, thanks very much.
Appreciate it.
Eric Bollard is a senior writer for Salon.com, and he's been following the FCC as it prepares to revise its limits on media ownership.
Here's a boogeyman one anti-deregulation group is sure will terrify the public into action.
Rupert Murdoch. He already owns Fox Network, Fox News, Fox Sports, FX, a newspaper, all these TV stations. But he wants more. So on June 2nd, Republicans on the FCC plan to get rid of an important regulation, so Rupert Murdoch can buy more TV stations, radio stations, newspapers, giving him control over much of the news you hear.
Rupert Murdoch is the Liberals' Captain Hook, the Fox News Channel his Jolly Roger, and Fox News founder Roger Ailes is his sardonic sidekick Smee, who brought aboard wily Bill O'Reilly and Sean Potshot Hannity.
And I think the ends justify the means in the minds of a liberal because their views are so superior to the views of everyone else. But you bring Hillary into this. Right.
For 4 months, New Yorker writer Ken Auletta immersed himself in Fox News and put Ailes under the microscope.
Roger Ailes has an aura of success in politics as a media consultant to Nixon, as a media consultant to Bush Sr., as a media consultant to Ronald Reagan. He was successful at creating CNBC and helping put it on the map. In addition to that, Roger Ailes treats everything like a political campaign, so he creates this sense of excitement that it's us against the world. In this case, it was us, meaning we conservatives, are going to fight the liberal bias in the media, and for once conservatives are going to have a voice in what he called the fair and balanced news network.
You liken him to General Patton. Can you give me an example of some Patton-like behavior?
When he walks down to the newsroom from his Fox office to the basement where 600 or so Fox News employees work, he will always put on his jacket, make sure his tie kisses his shirt collar, because he said that's what the troops expect of the old man. That's a general talking.
Now, you said that the point here, at least part of the point, was to give conservatives a television voice. And boy, did it. When Fox launched, it had access to 17 million homes. Now it has access to how many?
Well, it has access to about 80 million homes. And even though it's on fewer cable boxes than CNN by probably 8 or so million fewer homes, its audience is now considerably larger than CNN. In the last year and a half, Fox News has become the number one watched cable news network.
You suggested that CNN may have taken its cues from news radio when it began and that Fox took as its model talk radio.
Talk radio is full of anger. It gives people a chance to vent their anger. You saw this come to life with the Clinton impeachment case. But what Roger saw was that this was their vehicle to put Fox News on the map. And then after that came the 2000 election, and Fox News covered that as if it were World War III.
And then when we actually had a war,
the American flag in the left corner of the screen, and it became America's network. I had a fair number of stories about soldiers in Iraq, American soldiers, saying to people, "Are you with Fox News?" And saying, when they said, "No, we're with the Washington Post," they said, "Well, we're not going to talk to you. We would talk to you if you were Fox News." So Fox News has made major inroads and sold this message that they are the pro-American station. Now, that means that if you're a journalist and you criticize or you raise questions about whether the military had planned for policing Iraq and whether they had covered not just the oil ministry, but whether they had covered the museum in Baghdad to prevent looting, suddenly you're accused of being unpatriotic. Now, you know, that's not unpatriotic. That's reporting 101.
You spent a four-month immersion in Fox. How did you feel at the end of it, with all that anger and all that winking and all that yelling?
Well, I mean, sometimes I laughed, and sometimes I secretly applauded and said, you know, that they're doing good. And sometimes I agree with them that they were exposing, there are some hidden biases in the press and liberal biases, particularly on social issues, abortion, you know, gay rights, etc. So if you have a counterweight to that, that's not a bad thing. But in answer to your question, I often, as I was in effect embedded with Fox News for 4 months, I often wanted to scream at the set, just as a journalist, and say, my God, this is not fair and balanced. Or when they say, we report, you decide, it's really too often, we report, we decide. In the piece, I cite some examples of bias, and I confront Roger Ailes with it. For instance, I say to him, do you think putting Axis of Weasel under every French official who appears on Fox News, you think that's fair and balanced? And he says, well, we shouldn't do that. But then, did they stop doing that? No. And then when he at one point he criticized O'Reilly, but did O'Reilly stop being rude to people? No.
So would you be willing to speculate on what the impact of Fox News will be?
Well, we've already seen its impact. I think we see it in the defensiveness of CNN and their hiring of Connie Chung, which is they've since stopped. We see it on MSNBC, which basically has right-wing talk show hosts in the evening to try and compete with O'Reilly and Sean Hannity. The president of NBC News said to me, and it's in that piece, that in fact Fox constantly raising the question about liberal media bias has forced us to look at whether we do have media bias. By the way, I think that's a healthy thing. But Fox News does not examine itself, in my judgment, as to whether they have outright biases, and in fact use them in a much more aggressive way than the so-called liberal networks that they castigate.
Do you think they help set the tone for the country?
You cheapen the discourse when you yell at people. You cheapen the discourse when you don't explain your opponent's position, when you just assert that they're creeps or weasels or ain't patriotic. That's not democratic discourse. It's not civil. And I think it coarsens not just television and not just journalism, but the civic culture and democracy.
If you held a knife to Roger Ailes' throat, would he ever admit that Fox News is not fair and balanced?
No.
Okay, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Ken Auletta writes on media for The New Yorker. In this era of reality television, even the highest reaches of international diplomacy may be rudely exposed. Recently, Danish Prime Minister Anders Fogh Rasmussen was the subject of a fly-on-the-wall documentary filmed during his six-month stint as head of the European Union. His motive? To give voters insight into the secretive world of European decision-making. But he unwittingly cast his fellow EU politicians as bit players in his own reality TV show. Claire McCarthy wrote about the ensuing scandal for The Economist. Claire, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brooke.
Okay, so let's face it, the whole thing is delicious. Viewers were suddenly close up and personal with the hitherto unseen snottiness of diplomats behind closed doors. Let's start with the German Foreign Minister, Joschka Fischer. What happened to him?
Well, poor Joschka Fischer was exposed as a man who had several different opinions about the future of the European Union, and more particularly about whether Turkey should join or not. Now, Turkey's possible membership of the European Union is one of the most difficult problems that the Europeans are facing at the moment. Fischer said, we must find an alternative membership. They can never be full members. Now, stress on the never.
Yeah.
You know, the Turks have been told for 12, 15 years that one day they will reach the Holy Grail, one day they will be members of the European Union. And here suddenly is the foreign minister of one of their greatest allies, who in public supports them, saying in private, it won't go. They can't be members.
So let's see, the Germans were hit and the French.
The French were hit, and the Russians were also hit. In one of these corridors behind the scenes, Vladimir Putin said, journalists, they're all bandits, all of them. Now, that's not something that would go down very well with the press at home, is it?
So what are the repercussions of a slip of the lip on television?
In public, all the diplomats and all the government ministers all across Europe are saying, no, 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 this is all forgotten. We're all great friends. We're great buddies. In private, they're saying that it will take an awful long time before we can trust the Danes to keep their mouths shut in the future.
So what do you think the lasting diplomatic repercussions of the film will be?
Before this happened, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the Prime Minister, did such a tremendous job of the Danish European Union presidency. It really looked as if he could walk on water. And there has been some talk that at some stage in the future there would be a permanent president who would hold that post for perhaps 2 or 3 years at a time. He did such a good job during his 6 months that people had said he might possibly be the leader in the future. He scuppered those chances. He is no longer the cool, clean hero. The other repercussion is that he's created very bad feelings within his own government. This film showed everybody except Mr. Fogh Rasmussen in a very bad light. He looked like a hero, effective and efficient. Everybody else looked pretty stupid.
What do you think he expected from this sort of no-holds-barred exposure?
Well, Mr. Fogh Rasmussen had expected to endear the European Union rather more to the Danish public at large. The Danes are some of the most lackluster and most lukewarm European Union supporters who are already members. They don't want to be part of the single currency, and they have several other reservations besides. Anders Fogh Rasmussen wanted to make the European Union more popular.
Well, if the rest of the world is anything like the United States, there's nothing like a reality TV show to focus the attention, at least for a while.
Certainly not. And this was really a little bit like a cross between a candid camera and a Republican convention. The grey men in grey suits who we normally don't ever see. I thought it was wonderful. But I think this is possibly a one-off. I can't imagine any other government being foolish enough to trust themselves to a fly-on-the-wall cameraman.
Claire McCarthy, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Claire McCarthy is a correspondent for The Economist, and we spoke to her on the line in Copenhagen.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Blake Carlton. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for On the Media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John D. and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.